This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources was once a national leader in that space. New director Colleen Callahan says, though, it has been hollowed out by years of underfunding caused by state financial troubles and political deadlock.
When you're just in a survival mode, you don't accomplish much. You're just trying to make it through. Whatever the circumstances are, you're trying to survive.
GLT's Brianna Groh talks with Department of Natural Resources Director Colleen Callahan about the resurgence of the agency at the Rock Dairy Farm. Plus, Eric Stock reports on how zoos can be engulfed in a media firestorm. And U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth visits with GLT's Ryan Denham about corporate sexual harassment policies and more. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth says new sexual harassment policies at McDonald's don't go far enough because the company isn't requiring franchise locations to adopt them. McDonald's says it's offering new training and an anonymous tip line for employees to report harassment after years of complaints. In this interview with GLT's Ryan Denham, Duckworth says the problem is McDonald's says those changes are only required at corporate-owned stores.
And a vast majority of their locations are franchisees. And they're saying that the franchisees are not required to implement and enforce these new workplace harassment requirements, anti-harassment requirements. So great that they're updating their company policies for their corporate-owned stores, but it doesn't apply to the vast majority of their locations.
Does McDonald's have the contractual or legal authority to force that kind of top-down change on franchisees?
Well, they have the legal authority to tell them how many pickles to put on a hamburger. I would think they'd have the legal authority to tell them not to allow sexual harassment at their stores.
What kind of response have you gotten back from McDonald's on this latest letter, if any?
I think I'm going to be sitting down tomorrow with Robert Gibbs.
Robert Gibbs being the former White House press secretary under the Obama administration, who is now an executive at McDonald's. So I want to pivot to climate now. We've had some historic flooding across the Midwest, including here in Illinois this spring. When you see flooding like this, how much of it do you attribute to the human side of climate change, those things that we can maybe control with policy change in the future?
Well, I think it all comes together. I think there is definitely the increasing. I mean, we had one of the wettest springs in Illinois in a very long time. In fact, I think many of our farmers are just getting planting this week. It's June, and they're just now getting their crop into the ground. And I think that, yeah, definitely climate change is the cause of this. I do think that there are things that we can do, starting with conservation efforts, energy conservation efforts, and to try to move us off of a heavy reliance on fossil fuels. But then I also think that the flooding that happens could also be alleviated and prevented if we would spend some infrastructure dollars and help, fix many of our locks and dams, which are not in the greatest shape. Many of them have not been upgraded in 50 to 75 years.
And you sit on the Senate's Armed Services Committee, and I want to ask, how has this spring's flooding impacted military readiness, and how much of a threat is it moving forward at some of the bases that have experienced problems?
Well, it's significant, right? We have bases all around the country in North Carolina, for example, that the Sioux have not recovered for some of the hurricanes. We have now National Guard troops who are working on supporting with the floods, and that means that they're not doing other training that has to do with the specific military job skills. It's part of their job as a National Guard, and they're proud to do it, and I'm so glad that they're there. It does mean that they're not out there, doing some of their other training, unless you happen to be, you know, helicopter crews are still flying helicopters in support of the flood. So that's one thing. But really, it's a real threat to our national security in terms of the increase in precipitation, in more severe weather. There are over 100 military bases that are projected to be affected by flooding or will be underwater if we don't do something about climate change. And in fact, the mission set for military is only going to grow as peoples around the world are moved, are forced to migrate from one area to another, that causing conflict to happen. That's what happened in Rwanda. You know, people fleeing one severe drought, pushed into another region, and that led to conflict. Certainly, ISIS is taking advantage of prolonged drought in parts of the Middle East, and to expand their influence. So this is, you know, climate change is it's about flooding, it's about warmer weather, but it's also about national security as well.
Well, kind of a related note, last week, 17 different automakers asked the Trump administration to revisit its plan to weaken car pollution regulations, saying a move like that could threaten to create real instability in the auto market. I mean, these are some of the same automakers that asked for the weakening of the regulations in the first place, but setting that aside, they think that Trump went too far here. So what do you think the Trump administration should do here on car pollution regulations, and is there a role for Congress to step in as it relates to the Clean Air Act?
I mean, I think they need to go back to the standards set by the Obama administration, which, by the way, the auto manufacturers supported during the Obama administration because it gave them an advantage over their competitors. And American manufacturers had actually gotten to a point of efficiency that they were better, they could compete better than foreign auto manufacturers who could not meet our standards. And so they had a comparative advantage. And I think that weakening the standards might be a short-term thing, a gain, but really long-term, it's going to allow foreign competition for American manufacturers. So I think the auto manufacturers are smart to ask for a return to what the standards were, and that also will make it a lot more uniform for them because they have to adhere to the standards in California, which I think accounts for something like 30% of their automobile market or something in the country. So I think that these standards actually make U.S. auto manufacturers much more competitive on a global scale.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking by phone with Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat of Illinois. Many of the Democratic candidates for president in 2020 have released, you know, their own climate plans ranging in scale. Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State has basically made that the centerpiece issue of his campaign. What have you heard from the 2020 candidates on climate that you've liked? And what are some things that maybe are missing or haven't been focused on enough in your view?
Well, I mean, I like that they are addressing it. And I like that they have all said that, you know, the goal is a carbon neutral future, which I like, which is something it needs to be. And now how we get there is very different from candidate to candidate. I do think one thing that is missing from the dialogue that I certainly bring up with all of my colleagues, whether or not they're running for president, is the defense component, that the national security component of climate change and of the fact that, in making investments in clean energy actually can help our military be much more effective at doing its job. Not just about the bases that are going to be underwater, but, you know, if we would invest more money into, for example, better battery technologies, it can actually help make our troops more lethal. Because right now, you know, I remember from my time as a logistics officer for my unit, the amount of batteries I had to buy and figure out, and there were batteries for your night vision goggles, there was batteries for the laser tracking device on your weapon, there was batteries, two different types of batteries, two different types of radios, you had batteries for the encryption tool, batteries, you know, and so you end up with soldiers carrying, you know, a rucksack full of batteries instead of a rucksack full of ammunition. And so if we would make some of these investments in energy conservation and more effective technologies, it actually will make our military far more lethal and far more effective. And I think that is something that we as Democrats should be talking about. And so it's not just about what people think is traditional green, progressive values. Yes, that's true, but there is real world implications for keeping our military on the cutting edge of technology and really leading our global competitorism and great power competition for the strength of our military if we would make these investments. I mean, in Iraq, for example, everything ran on generators, right? So I was at LSA Anaconda, and you know, our tactical operations center had generators running food nonstop. All of the housing units had generators running nonstop, and yet 80% of all convoys, 50% of all casualties that happened in Iraq were during convoy operations, not going out and kicking down doors looking for Al-Qaeda. 50% was from convoy operations, and 80% of all convoys was to transport diesel fuel. And yet we had these chow halls going for literally a decade in Iraq, throwing away food scraps and burning them. Well, why weren't we not turning that stuff into biodiesel so that we could burn that biodiesel to run those generators? And, you know, that would, every 5,000-gallon tanker I could keep off the roads was two soldiers who was safe from enemy attack in terms of ambushes, but there's also meant two soldiers I could put out there to go after the bad guys on a real mission.
So in Illinois, we are, I think, about one signature away from legalizing recreational marijuana starting January 1st. The state treasurer here has lobbied for federal legislation that would remove the risk of federal sanctions on banks that interact with legal state cannabis businesses in preparation for this. Do you support a measure like that? Has there been any momentum on that issue in the last few months in the Capitol?
Once it has been signed, you know, I do support some sort of access to legal financial services for these businesses, because right now, from what I can tell, looking at the cases in other states, it's incredibly dangerous. They're having to operate on a cash basis. You know, I mean, it's almost like they're back to the old Welch Park Go Wagon horse-drawn carriage, you know, with two guys with shotguns safeguarding a chest full of cash. And sort of that's where we are. And I don't think that anybody wants to have that type of a situation long term. So yeah, I will be very supportive of some sort of federal policy in order to allow financial services products to be extended to businesses that deal in legal marijuana in those states where it has been, you know, where it has been passed.
In the past, you've supported removing marijuana from the list of scheduled substances under the Controlled Substances Act, which makes it legal federally to sell and possess marijuana. So as more and more states like Illinois are legalizing, do you sense that the federal government's hand may be forced at some point to revisit this issue? Do you sense any interest in that or appetite for that among your colleagues in the Senate?
I would tell you that that's not one of the things that is a topic that is frequently discussed in the Senate. Right now, our focus is really on the trade war with China. That is hurting my farmers today. It's hurting my manufacturers today. And so I know my focus is on trade. My focus is on investment in infrastructure. My focus is on the military and veterans issues. I just don't see that this is one of the, you know, even top 10 topics that gets brought up for discussion up here. I don't know that it's because people are not interested in it. I just think that we have so many other pressing issues that we're dealing with. But I do think, you know, state after state, if you get to the point where the majority of the states have legalized it, then yeah, you're going to have to deal with it as a nation. But right now, my focus is the fact that, you know, I have 2,500 bridges in Illinois that have been deemed structurally deficient, and yet we're still using them.
U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth talking with GLT's Ryan Denham. The marijuana legalization bill has passed the General Assembly and is awaiting Governor J.B. Pritzker's signature.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropists of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the fatal case of the fractured flamingo and the media firestorm it ignited. Eric Stock has that story. Among the many state agencies that faced erosion in staff and resources over the last decade is the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. The new head of the DNR under the Pritzker administration is Colleen Callahan. GLT correspondent Brianna Groh caught up with Callahan at the Ropp Dairy Farm west of Normal.
With many other agencies in the state, the IDNR has been put on the back burner over the last decade and certainly over the last 4 years. What are your priorities in rebuilding the agency's capacity?
I view my role as being the advocate for the Department of Natural Resources, for the agency, and for those staff people who have dedicated their professional careers to the mission. And they are not unlike teachers that we know who sometimes dig into their own pockets to help get a uniform for a student, whether it be for an athletic event or whether it be for a musical or a play, just an extracurricular activity where they may need something to participate, and the teacher will help. You talked about the agency being hollowed out, and it has been, staffing-wise, and that means that oftentimes our parks, our site superintendents, in order to make that facility available for that day or that weekend when people are expecting to be able to enjoy the park, and there's something that needs to be fixed or repaired, they'll dig into their own pocket and make sure that the plumbing works in the restroom. So my role and how do I hope to approach that? It is to be the representative, is to be the advocate, so that when I'm testifying before the Appropriations Committee, I make it clear that we have needs and expectations of the citizens of Illinois. It is likely that our natural resources, and particularly our parks, our museums, we probably have the most direct contact with the citizens of Illinois than any other agency. Now, direct is the operative word there, because you say, well, yeah, we pay taxes, so we have to work with the Department of Revenue, and yes, we have all these other things, but that's not a direct relationship. But visiting a park or museum or historic site, going fishing, using public lands for hunting, that's very direct contact. And if any of those are in disrepair, then that reflects on the state of our government as well. So to be the advocate and to defend why we need additional funding or why we need support or more staffing is my role, and how I intend to continue in the role some 90 days in the position. I don't know that my philosophy will change about how I approach my philosophy on representing the department. I should be its number one advocate.
And is there, as you said, 90 days in, a plan with this agency and in the Pritzker administration on how to get the IDNR moving forward, as you said, from staffing cuts and with requesting additional funds?
The administration has already expressed their support, and I'll give you a couple of examples. When I toured our Illinois State Museum with Governor Pritzker a few weeks ago, I learned from our staff, not from Governor Pritzker's staff, but from our museum staff, that Governor Pritzker is the first governor to request a tour of the museum since Governor Thompson. That's before you were likely born. And there have been governors on both sides since Governor Thompson. So I'm not being political here. I am not, because we've had representation from both sides since then. And this is the first governor to ask to visit the museum. That shows interest and support. Later that afternoon, I was invited to meet with the First Lady at the governor's mansion, because IDNR, again, plays a role in the mansion because it is another historic site, and we have a relationship there. And the First Lady regretted that earlier in the day when her husband was visiting the museum that she couldn't join him. And so she said, I want to come, and I want the same kind of tour that he got. They're also making arrangements to visit historic sites, whether it's New Salem or whether it is Cahokia Mounds or whether it's Dixon Mounds. So I think to know that, coming on the heels when the museum was actually closed, when we did not have a budget for over 2.5 years, and most of the staff was dismissed as a consequence of that, you can imagine the pride that the staff had to know that it was the governor who asked to come without their invitation. So as far as it relates to support for our programs at the Department of Natural Resources, the governor and his staff have been very attentive and are very interested.
You are the first woman to hold this position. In this day and age, are we beyond the need of pointing out those firsts?
Well, it is a fact that I am the first woman, but it was never a goal, nor was it ever a goal of mine to be the first woman to do anything. It just sort of happened that way. Before we started the interview, I was sharing with you that I did what you're currently doing for over 30 years in Peoria on radio and television. And when I started right out of college from the University of Illinois in the fall of 1973, there were no women who were doing agricultural broadcasting. And I didn't want to do it to be the first. It just so happened that I was the first. And I sought the opportunity. And that station at that time was willing to take a chance. And it worked for them, and it worked for me for over 30 years. There have been other firsts as well, and they can be noted, but they're not the should never be the lead story about a responsibility. Again, I'm proud of the fact that I am, but it was never part of any plan. So I'm honored to be in the position to serve alongside with the staff that is so incredibly dedicated to the mission. It's an honor, and frankly, many days it's humbling.
What is the headline for you, thinking about your experience leading up to this position? What are you most proud of that you're able to bring to it and to the IDNR?
I'm proud of the fact that my background has served me so well as it relates to what I have been able to offer, whether I was at the radio and TV station communicating about agriculture, whether I was at USDA Rural Development and leading an agency that had loans and grants that could help benefit our rural communities, or whether now it's at the Department of Natural Resources. Foundationally for me, it begins with communication. When we don't communicate, when there is lack, no, or poor communication, nothing gets done because it's already ended. It's never gotten started. If you don't communicate. To communicate is the beginning of understanding. Listening is a very big part of the communication process. And the next piece of that foundation is to collaborate. And the other for me is to connect. So if you would walk into the building at the Department of Natural Resources in Springfield today, or if you were out in the field at one of our parks or facilities, and you said, have you met Colleen yet, or do you know her, or what do you know about her, or what do you think about her? I am pretty confident that to a person, they would say, well, I don't know her very well, but I know that she always says she starts every meeting, and she concludes every meeting with communicate, collaborate, connect. And in the short time that I've been there, and we have started to make that an emphasis, I notice a difference, and so does the staff. When they say to me, we just never talked about this before. It was just either assumed or we'd never done it that way. And I would say, you know, I flunk mind reading. So unless you tell me what you believe I need to know and that I should know in order to help me make decisions about and for the agency, I need to know. I need you to share with me what you know and what you've experienced over time. And only then can I make decisions going forward. We can never go back. We can only go forward. But they have the history that I don't. And so that I've tried to be a good listener and base my decisions on a collaborative effort.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Brianna Groh. I'm talking with Colleen Callahan. She's the new head of the IDNR. So many of the past DNR heads have either been scientists, biologists, or former politicians. So tell me about what a federal ag background gives you as far as a different frame of reference in considering things like water quality, habitat preservation, species restoration, etc.
It was clear during the transition for the Pritzker administration when John Sullivan, who is now the Director of Agriculture, and I co-chaired the Agriculture and Rural Development Transition Committee, that as we went around the room and the participants introduced themselves and said what their number one issue was that they wanted to elevate during our conversations for these three meetings that we had in the transition. It became clear that there are synergies, there are relationships that I don't know, because I've not worked in state government before, have either been acknowledged or have taken the time to recognize that there is a relationship. So when one of the participants would talk about our nutrient loss reduction strategy, aren't we talking about water quality there? Well, the Department of Natural Resources has the Office of Water. That's part of what we do. We deal in quantity. EPA deals in quality. But we're talking about water. So agriculture and DNR should be working together. When someone would bring up in that transition committee about cover crops, isn't that about preserving our soil? And isn't soil and water our natural resources? So we should be working together. And so John and I have begun to do that. We have a little competition going at the moment with our monarch butterfly habitats. They are by some considered to possibly be listed as an endangered species. That determination has not been yet made, but while we are waiting to learn whether or not they will be listed on an endangered species list, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources are working collaboratively to help bring awareness of the issue. Certainly the Illinois Farm Bureau has been very active as well. So the competition I'm referring to is that we have planted pollinator plots on the fairgrounds, one at the Department of Agriculture, several at the Department of Natural Resources. And so we're going to see who wins that competition, to see whose plot either is the most bountiful, attracting the most monarch butterflies. And I told Director Sullivan, I said, now, externally to the public, I will accept a tie, but internally, I'm in it to win it.
Well, best of luck to you on that competition. So there are 14 different departments in the DNR, is that correct? Mines, minerals, natural gas, wildlife. You've said that your goal is to return the DNR to the prominence it once held among similar agencies. Where has it slipped?
At one time, and before my time, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources was one of the, if not the most highly regarded throughout the United States. And as we began to recognize that the department wasn't being supported either financially or with staffing, the staff, if there was someone here from our staff right now and you turn the microphone to them and say, what has it been like over the last 4 years, and does it feel any differently today than it did a year ago? I've heard them say this just in conversation, that they were just in survival mode. And when you take that to a personal level, when you're just in a survival mode, you don't accomplish much. You're just trying to make it through whatever the circumstances are. You're trying to survive. And in their words, that's what they have been doing for the last several years. Today, we do have a budget. We are passing legislation. We do have an administration that is supportive. And while we haven't been involved long enough to say, gee, look at these parks and how much better they look, we can't say that in 90 days. But here's what we can say. Because we have not been able to do the big things that need to be done, I ask the staff almost immediately, but we can do little things. So let's take the funding that we have and let's begin to do the little things that will be noticeable. Maybe it's nothing more than putting down fresh gravel on the entry to a park. Maybe it's nothing more than putting up new signage at the park. Maybe it's nothing more than finally taking that tarp down off a portion of a roof and actually repairing that roof. Those are things that you can notice. And those are things that we do have funding available to do. So little by little, we are beginning to make progress and changes, and it feels differently than it did.
Well, Colleen Callahan, thank you so much for talking with me. She is the new director of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. I'm Brianna Groh.
And with the state coming out of a particular wet spring, Callahan also says discussions are underway to change the state's approach to floods from response to prevention.
Partnering with GLT works for Specs Around Town.
I just feel that the GLT listeners, the audience, are somewhat the influencers in our community. Hi, my name's Julie Kupsch, and I'm the owner of Specs Around Town.
A GLT underwriter for almost two decades.
Our clients are people that realize the importance of shopping local.
Partnering with GLT works for Specs Around Town. Find out how it can work for you at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from SmartVet, the only mobile veterinary practice serving the Bloomington-Normal area. Your pet's healthcare experience is simplified when the vet comes to you. Details at thesmartvet.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a federal prison in Thompson, Illinois, looks to expand but is having difficulty finding bodies to fill the staff. Jay Tetzloff got a lesson in public relations crisis management he did not predict when he showed up for work at Miller Park Zoo one Monday last month. Bloomington Zoo director and head of its Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Arts departments became entrenched in a story that grabbed international headlines after a young patron struck a flamingo with a rock. The zoo had to euthanize the bird. Tetzloff tells GLT's Eric Stock media inundated his office with requests about a matter he wanted kept private.
It's not what I want us to be known for the Miller Park Zoo from the national perspective. I had probably around 60 news outlets from all over the country and all over the world reach out to me. We only sent two-sentence responses to pretty much everybody. We were kind of hoping to keep this on the down low since it's no one won. This is a no-win situation. We lost our bird, and the amount of hate mail that I got over this was, I think, ridiculous, and it was disappointing.
Where was the hate mail coming from?
We said it was an accident. I don't think anybody's going to know if it was an accident or not. This was a young kid. He's the only one who knows if it was an accident or not. So we did our best to work with the family and wanted, I mean, I really did want this to go away. I've been honest for the last couple weeks about that. Again, not wanting us to be known for I want us to be known for a great alligator exhibit we just built or the palace cat kittens we just had born, something like that, not of an incident where we lost a bird.
Well, of course, there are some who say there's no such thing as bad publicity. Maybe that's what brings people in to find out about all the things that you do offer here.
Yeah, I mean, we had a great May in terms of attendance, broke the all-time gate revenue record for the month of May of any month we've ever had. And the zoo's been around since 1891, so it's not just a short-term record. But, I know alligators had a lot to do with that. Maybe flamingos had something to do with that, too.
So the hate mail that you were getting, was there an expectation that they were going to haul the kid away, that there were going to be charges? What was that stemming from?
It was for everything. It was the anti-zoo, which we get periodically, and I understand that. I wish zoos didn't have to be around either. I wish we could have animals in habitats in the wild, and everyone's doing great. We don't have any endangered species, but that's not the world we live in. It was everything from shouldn't have a zoo to you should have, it's your job to take care of the animals. The kids should be dealt with. This was no accident. And probably everything in between that.
And you had initially kept this quiet, as you said, nothing online, nothing on social media. As you said, a two-sentence response to those who had inquired about it. How did word get out that this had happened?
There was a posting on Facebook that kind of started it. So this happened.
And it wasn't a Miller Park Zoo posting.
It was not a posting from the zoo or zoo staff. It was, I mean, this happened in the public's view. So, I had somebody that I know went up to and told somebody, hey, I was there that day. I saw it happen. So, we had 600 or 700 people at the zoo that day. So a lot of people saw it, and somebody, the word got around.
I don't imagine there's really a blueprint for how to handle this kind of thing, at least from a public response. What sort of guided your decision-making process on how to manage this from a public relations standpoint?
You're right. I've been in the business 32 years now and have never had to deal with anything like this. I think at the end of day one, maybe it was beginning of day two, I called two friends of mine who are zoo directors and been zoo directors for 30-some years and said, hey, here's what happened. What would you guys do? And I got the same response that I had. Boy, that's a good one. It isn't something that comes up in a lot of our discussions. My viewpoint was to be private, to handle the family privately. It was no one's responsibility or no one's responsibility is not the right word. I didn't feel it was worthy to, post publicly who it was, where they're from, anything. We've talked with the family. I'm okay with how we handled it with the family. I just think we were trying to, in some cases, protect the family. The bird was gone. I can't go back. If I could, I'd hit the reset for that Monday morning and say, this doesn't happen. We lost the bird. I know the family feels horrible. And it's just one of those things that it's an unfortunate incident. And I hope we handled, maybe 2 years from now, we'll go back to it and go, did we handle it right? That's the best I can do at this point.
Had you considered putting out a brief message, perhaps on social media, something along those lines, while, of course, respecting the family's privacy to sort of try to get out ahead of it, possibly, that may have stemmed some of that pushback?
We did. We talked about a couple things, but I think the bigger, it was already out there, and the nastiness that comes out of social media sometimes was out there, and I guess I wasn't trying to do anything that could possibly be considered fuel on the fire. And again, we just kind of laid low and let it go and let it burn itself out.
And of course, part of the attraction of zoos like Miller Park Zoo is the intimacy that you get with the animals that you don't necessarily get in some of the larger ones. Do you simply chalk this up to stuff happens? You can't supervise every patron every moment they're here?
I think so. Eric, we talked about we've talked about the staff. Well, how do we prevent this? It was a rock that was picked up out of landscaping, not next to the exhibit. And the group was chaperoned. It wasn't a lack of supervision. It happened quickly, and that's all it takes. I don't want to lose the intimacy that we have. I think that's one of the best things about our zoo. And we're at a zoo where those things don't happen until they do. And that's something we've had to kind of deal with since then.
Any changes as a result?
We've been talking internally. We talked about having minimums with the amount of with these amount of kids, you got to have these amount of chaperones. That's really never been a problem for us, and it wasn't a problem in this incident. So even if we had mandated the things we've started to talk about, it still may not have stopped it. We're going to put some minimums in place of you have to be X amount of age to be able to come in on your own. We figured if you're paying an adult. If you're paying a child admission fee, then you can't come in by yourself. I mean, it's as simple as that. If we're saying a 12-year-old is an adult because that's how we charge them, then 12-year-olds can be responsible for themselves. But below that, you have to come in with an adult.
And, of course, parents can't control where they are every second, too.
Right.
It's just what happens,
Right. This happened really fast. Again, unfortunate incident. It's been a no-win situation.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Jay Tetzloff, who is Director of Miller Park Zoo and Director of Bloomington Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Arts. And this has been a particularly tough time for the Parks Department. Last Friday was the funeral for Joe Olson. Coach Joe, as he was known, really the godfather of the local hockey movement, he died of a heart attack. How would you describe what impact Coach Joe had on hockey in this community as a relatively new sport since the Pepsi Ice Center opened back in 2006?
Joe was everything about hockey. At his funeral on Friday, hearing his brother talk about things I didn't know, Joe played semi-pro hockey as a senior in high school. That's pretty cool. When you think about hockey then, that was more like slapstick. Slapshot than the NHL you see today. I mean, it was much rougher and dirty, really, then. So to hear about him able to play that as a senior in high school is pretty amazing. But, you know, the thing I heard over and over from the parents of Bloomington Hockey and just the community was, if my kid walked into the place the first time, the second time he walked in, Joe would know his name. That's a phenomenal trait and skill set.
With hundreds of kids.
Yes. And adults, I heard one adult was, there were like 20 years between the first time and the second time, and Joe remembered who they were. That's pretty phenomenal. I think, without a doubt, Joe built the hockey that we see here in Bloomington Normal. No doubt in my mind about that. Now it's our job to make sure it keeps growing in tribute to Joe.
Is there anything in particular that Pepsi Ice Center is doing to help carry on that legacy?
You know, we're going to be looking at programming. It's summer, so we're working on our summer camps right now. But this fall, you know, we'll be looking at, you know, what did Joe do? Everybody is good at what they do, but could be better. And so we want to take what Joe did well and make it better. And so, you know, down the road, we'll hire new staff to replace Joe, which will be a very hard shoe to fill. But we've got to be able to move forward, too. And Joe would understand that and would want that. But, we're hoping to grow hockey here, continue to grow hockey as we've done in the past.
And, of course, at the pro and semi-pro level, the teams that have played at the arena have sort of had their ups and downs. Do you look at those two things together or separate? Because hockey as a participation sport has grown continually every year, regardless of what happens at the spectator level.
With hockey here at the Ice Center, it's been huge. You know, we don't have enough ice time to go around. And then you see, the USHL team struggle and not coming back next year. For at least a year. It was surprising for me. I've been at other communities where the building was a sellout, and it was USHL. So I would hear things like, well, it's not good hockey. Come out and watch it. You know, it's these are potential NHL picks. Or I'd say, do you like college hockey? Then, I mean, these guys are going to have a scholarship next year, or, you know, that's what they're playing for. It was good hockey the majority of the time. So it's disappointing to see those two didn't kind of jive together and move hockey forward in this community.
Could it have something to do with the fact that the arena has had its issues and some of its perception problems going back to the beginning, those that didn't want it here and decided that they weren't going to support whatever was in there?
Yeah, I've had one gentleman say, I'm a hockey fan, but I won't go to the Coliseum. And I struggle with that. I can't imagine this community without it. I moved here just about 10 years ago. And that's what I go to the most. I'm a hockey fan. I'll wear my Penguins jersey at games when I go. So it's disappointing that people would make that choice, but, you know, it's how they feel. I can't change how they feel, but I think they missed out on good quality hockey when it was here.
Well, that's Bloomington Parks Recreation and Cultural Arts Director Jay Tetzloff with GLT's Eric Stock. Tomorrow on Sound Ideas, Tetzloff discusses the future of the aging O'Neill Pool and whether the state's new capital bill gives him hope it could be converted into an aquatic center. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A federal prison in Thompson, Illinois, is looking to expand its workforce. They're facing difficulty finding workers to settle down there. IPR's Chase Cavanaugh has more.
Thompson Prison was built in 2001. It sat empty for years until it was bought by the Federal Bureau of Prisons in 2012. The prison has slowly boosted its hiring and operations since 2015. Local residents were optimistic about a new jobs pipeline, and Thompson Village President Vicki Traeger says there's solid evidence of new hires.
More traffic through town, more customers at the local gas station, convenience store, that sort of thing.
But it's been difficult to attract new workers to the area because of Thompson's limited amenities.
It's hard to believe we have no retail in Thompson, and we have limited housing. The housing that we do have is mostly older, small, single-family homes. We have some income-based multi-unit apartment buildings.
Michelle Horst is a human resource specialist for the Bureau of Prisons. She says this lack of amenities means employees commute an average of 30 miles to work.
Most employees reside in Illinois cities of Thompson, Savannah, Mount Carroll, Fulton, Morrison, and the Sterling Rock Falls area, as well as Clinton, Iowa. However, we do have some employees that commute as far as 50 to 70 miles or more, including a significant number in the Quad Cities area.
In response, the warden sent out a letter May 24th to the governments of Thompson and its surrounding communities. It outlined the prison's goal to increase its staff from 400 to around 600. Spokeswoman Nicole McDowell says the letter also addresses the lack of development.
Some of the current concerns we've had from potential staff is housing, schools, and daycares. So we were reaching out to the community in hopes that they'll see we are here, we're open, we're staying, and we'll start developing in the area for those staff.
This can be particularly important for the more specialized workers Thompson is trying to hire. Horst explains.
We're also filling positions in our departments of health services to include a clinical director, physician, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, registered nurse, paramedic, and then we also have clinical psychologist positions to fill.
The lingering issue for Thompson has been the prison's history. It's been in Thompson for more than 20 years, but operations didn't begin in earnest until it was bought by the feds. Traeger says this perception of inactivity leaves developers cautious.
And I appreciate that most folks aren't in the business of losing money on a grocery store or an apartment structure. I get it. But there's a lot of grant money out there, and there are a lot of housing credits out there that are available now. And one of the biggest obstacles I have, and that I think the warden's letter addressed, is to just convince people that it's really real.
Since the release of the warden's letter, McDowell says several communities have responded with commitments to new development.
Outside of Thompson, Mount Carroll let us know that they've got they're doing a renovation there that's going to provide lots and lots of housing. And Clinton let us know that they are about to do another housing area, sort of like the landing that they have, that would also house a lot of staff.
The response from outside communities doesn't directly address the lack of development in Thompson, but Traeger says the village isn't strictly in competition with his neighbors.
A town the size of Thompson can't absorb 600 new prison staff. We know it has to be spread around, and we know that a lot of them are living in Fulton or Savannah or Mount Carroll.
For now, the Bureau of Prisons has designated Thompson a hard-to-fill institution, allowing staff to offer a variety of hiring and pension incentives. As for Thompson itself, Traeger hopes the warden's recent letter can get the word out about new job hires and attract future developers.
All I can do is hope that the warden, coming from him, now they will believe it. And now they will come and say, oh, you know, let's check out this town.
I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Sometimes the subject matter of what you learn in class is not actually the lesson. For instance, a techie camp for kids offers more than video game design. IPR's Chase Cavanaugh, again, has more.
STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And educators at all levels are encouraging students to study these subjects. Much of this has to do with the economic growth of Silicon Valley and the higher salaries that jobs in the tech sector can provide. Exposing students to these more advanced subjects can start as early as elementary and middle school. Becky Griffith is an instructor at Northern Illinois University's Digital Convergence Lab. She runs a video game coding camp for elementary and middle school girls.
They get to draw their characters, kind of create a storyboard, you know, thinking critically that way, and then as well as coding and making their game run.
The campers use an engine called GameMaker to translate their ideas into software. Amelia, one of the participants, describes the art she's creating for her game.
Basically, you're a squid trying to get through a maze in the undersea, and the enemy is an anglerfish.
The camp draws on many different skills, such as design, art, and coding. It also introduces Amelia and others to concepts like revising code.
There's always stuff you gotta work out and other things that might go wrong.
Activities like this camp show how different elements interact and how to apply different areas of knowledge. But now, teachers are also emphasizing skills that one would regularly use in a professional setting. In the coding camp, for example, group work is a common sight. It also extends into the school year. Dr. Heather Saltis is the special programs director at Rockford Public Schools. Her purview includes the system's STEAM Academy, with the A standing for arts.
It's all very collaborative, so working with others, having to compromise and collaborate, having to communicate what you really want and really need in order to get the job done and deliver what your initial idea is. Those are all the soft skills that start, I think, with a STEAM focus. That's the lens.
That is emphasized even more in higher education courses. Judson Curry is the Dean for Arts, Communication, and Social Sciences at Kishwaukee College. He says employers want career candidates to have a strong set of these soft skills.
The ability to communicate well in spoken language or written language, the ability to work collaboratively in a team, the ability to think critically and to analyze problems, knowing how to research, knowing how to find information, how to examine and assess the information and know what's good information.
Many of these skills can come from a standard liberal arts curriculum, but Curry says students of STEM can also expand their horizons in unexpected ways. He gives the example of Steve Jobs taking a college calligraphy course.
Understanding print faces and type fonts and the importance of visuals in communication, and that went right into his development of the graphical user interface that Apple became famous for.
Educators want students to develop the critical thinking and knowledge base that comes from a liberal arts education. They also hope to encourage the kinds of Steve Jobs moments that can come from studying outside one's major. Dr. Judy Ledgerwood is acting dean of Northern Illinois University's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. She says one way to encourage this study is by requiring a certain amount of liberal arts classes to graduate. But this can be less effective if students already took advanced placement college courses in high school.
A certain number of students would come in and in their gen ed classes, they would say, oh, I like that history class. Now I'm going to major in history. Or I like that anthropology class. Now I'm going to major in anthropology. But because they've taken the AP class, they don't.
Regardless of how STEM students are led to liberal arts courses, Curry of Kishwaukee College says if it's a subject they enjoy, the students will expand their studies.
Once they taste it, they realize that these liberal arts areas, the arts, the sciences, the social sciences, the humanities, they're not broccoli. They're ice cream, and they're delicious, and they just want more of them.
Educators hope this and a solid grounding in soft skills lead to well-rounded students at all levels. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from Eric Stock, Brianna Groh, and Ryan Denham. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.